So the governor made his big announcement last night. It was basically a public plea as the reach of the coronavirus spreads in Washington.
In just the last 2 days, there have been close to 3,400 new cases of coronavirus reported in Washington state. The latest modeling from the University of Washington's Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation now predicting just over 7,000 deaths in the state by March. Far too many for Governor Inslee, who in a rare move last night addressed the state with his wife, Trudy.
We'd like to talk tonight about what is being called the third wave of COVID-19 and how we can protect our families as we head into the holidays that we cherish so much. Simply put, we have to rethink these holidays so that we may be thankful when we don't lose more lives to COVID.
Like many of you, we Inslees love our Thanksgiving celebrations. For decades, we'd started the day off with a touch football game, followed with a potluck with family and friends, and then we finish it off with pie and turkey sandwiches.
But this year, things are going to be different.
This year, our family will celebrate Thanksgiving and Christmas, but we'll do it virtually. But here's some good news. We're only going to have to do this once. This is a unique Thanksgiving and holiday season. We're thankful that more therapeutics are on the way, as is the imminent arrival of a vaccine. And so there is a lot more at our disposal to fight this virus than there was when the pandemic began. We are optimistic that Thanksgiving 2021 will be the best ever. But this year, it's just too dangerous to gather together indoors where the virus can spread so easily.
Leading to a public plea from the couple.
Please don't gather with people outside your household. It's just too dangerous.
And here's why.
Here's the hard facts. Our weekly average of new COVID cases has doubled just in the past 2 weeks. We are in as dangerous a position today as we were in March. We're in a period of what's called exponential growth, and every single day matters. We cannot wait until our hospital's halls are lined with gurneys waiting for rooms before we take decisive action.
The good news?
We have done some good work already in our state. Washingtonians have masked up, and business owners have found innovative ways to adapt to health measures, putting our state in a better position than the vast majority of other states for now.
The bad?
In the next few days, we will be announcing some further measures to prevent this from spreading. These decisions will affect what we do outside of the home. But what's most urgent right now tonight is what we do in our own dwellings. Tonight, we have a simple request from our family to yours.
That request?
Please do not have Thanksgiving gatherings unless you're positive that everyone there has quarantined successfully for 14 days, which would start today.
Otherwise, every social gathering is just one more brick in a wall of infection. It's not just Thanksgiving, but it's also your birthday parties, your Seahawks celebrations. It doesn't matter what you're doing. These gatherings in your homes are dangerous right now.
There's no hint yet as to exactly what those new restrictions might look like, but the governor has been meeting with various industries to find the least harmful way to handle the situation. The governor and his wife closed their address with various thank yous for all of the essential workers and those in the healthcare industry, and acknowledge the difficulty of COVID fatigue.
You know, we're all fatigued, and it's okay to not feel okay right now. But what happens next in our state depends on what happens in our families and in our homes. That's why we implore you, rethink spending time with people outside of your household on Thanksgiving and the December holidays.
Everybody can be a leader here, and we need you to be a leader tonight. It's time to have difficult but necessary conversations with your family about the holidays.
Otherwise, we're going to be in for much darker days, according to the governor.
We know phone calls and video chats. We're talking to each other through windows or plexiglass. They're not a replacement for in-person connections. We all know that. But they are viable for now because every gathering will risk spreading COVID-19. Until the time comes when we have finally wrestled this virus to the ground, which we will accomplish together.
Hannah Scott. Yeah, we canceled our plans. We're not going to go see the grandbaby turn 2 years old. It just, it got too dicey. Reservations were made and everything. Had to pull the plug. Sad.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, Dave. Are you still going to do like a virtual?
Well, yeah, I mean, we do that quite a bit.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
And here it is Friday. Time for our resident historian Felix Bunnell to take us all over the map, where he examines why things are named what they're named. And this week, we have three communities in Washington with one unusual thing in common when it comes to their names, Felix.
Yes, and that one thing is the name of the place is another name intentionally spelled backwards.
No.
Okay, here we go. Yes. Don't you wish your name was Bob so we could just spell your name backwards and it would be Bob? Okay, here we go. First isn't really a town anymore, but 100 years ago, the trackside community of Nagram was home to a sawmill owned by Elmer Morgan. You see what they did there?
I see.
Some Northern Pacific Railway employee gets a credit for spelling Morgan backwards to come up with Nagram. From the old newspaper clippings, it sounds like it was kind of a rough and tumble place. Mm-hmm. It lost its post office way back on New Year's Eve, 1936.
That's too bad.
Now, next we go over to Kitsap County, right across Sinclair Inlet from Bremerton and the Naval Shipyard to the Port Orchard community of Retzel.
Retzel.
When the Washington Veterans Home was built there in 1910, they needed a name for the post office. I'm not sure what the other possibilities were, but a guy named W.H. Cochran, kind of a political guy, suggested spelling Governor Ernest Lister's surname backwards. Now, Lister stepped down early from his second term in February 1919 and died that June at age 48. Cochran, who some thought might run for governor in 1920, died in April 1919, also unexpectedly. So there's no one to talk to about how this all happened. The only other governor whose name works backwards, after looking at the big long list, I think is probably Governor Martin in the 30s, Nitram, which is what we call my brother Martin sometimes. So
Nitram?
Okay. Yep, and he responds to it. Now, for my favorite of Washington's backwards towns, no Tacoma or Spokane jokes here, please. In Pacific County, on Highway 12, between Francis and Holcomb, where Half Moon Creek empties into the Willapa River, is the town of Labam.
Yeah,
back
I've heard
of that. Back in 1890. Yeah, yeah, you've probably driven through it 100 times. The place was known as Half Moon or Half Moon Prairie. One version of the story says the post office didn't approve of Half Moon as one word. So town founder Jotham W. Goodell reversed the letters of his 3 or 4 year old daughter's first name. Uh-huh. She was Mabel Pearl Goodell.
Mabel.
And Mabel, who married Charles Thompson, lived to be 89, passed away in Seattle in 1976.
Wow.
So that's probably my favorite one because it's such a great name. Mabel and Labam has such a kind of an active sound to it. So
are those the only ones that are backwards names?
You know, there are the only three towns I know of. There's a neighborhood on Camano Island that's called Onamac, which is Camano spelled backwards. Uh-huh. And if there's others people know of, hit us up at the text line.
There's
some I've missed. I'd love to hear about them.
Felix Bunnell, every Wednesday and Friday, all his features at MyNorthwest.com.
Your daily dose of kindness is brought to you by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. An inspiring 7-year-old boy in Maryland is on a mission to help people in need. Earlier this year, he reached out to residents of a rural Indian reservation in South Dakota to send badly needed supplies. And CBS's Chip Reed says this ambitious second grader didn't stop there.
I dream big.
You dream big.
So big that Cavanaugh Bell, at 4 feet tall, filled 2 53-foot trailers to help people he'd never met.
How did you get 2 truckloads full of supplies?
It's magic.
It's magic?
It's Operation Magic.
Operation Magic.
Magic may be the only explanation that makes sense for how this Maryland second grader raised more than $36,000 for food and clothing and then had it trucked halfway across the country.
Welcome to Pine Ridge.
To this South Dakota reservation, one of the poorest places in the nation.
What's up, guys?
Kavanaugh first saw it 2 years ago on a trip to Mount Rushmore with his mother, Lacey.
They were so grateful that someone from 1,500 miles away, that's only 7, would put together this effort.
For some kids, that would be enough for 1 year, but Kavanaugh saw the need back home and began building mobile pantries he stocks with supplies to help his community.
How much of it is coming from you and how much of it is coming from him?
I would say like 95% of it's coming from him. I'll throw out something that I think is relatively doable in my adult schedule, and Kavanaugh will be like, no, that's not enough.
It started at age 4 when he helped his mom send safe drinking water to Flint, Michigan. When coronavirus hit, Kavanaugh created care packages for seniors so they wouldn't have to go out shopping.
Hello.
That's when some big names noticed.
In Maryland, a 7-year-old boy used his own birthday money to buy meals for dozens of senior citizens.
I've helped
8,126 people. So I guess you could say I'm kind of busy.
Do you get nervous talking to important, famous people like Kamala Harris?
No. I get shaky, and then I'm clutch.
You're clutch.
Yeah.
But Kavanaugh wasn't always that confident. He endured bullying in preschool.
I had a darkness inside of me.
And where did that darkness come from?
It was just from them being mean.
But it gave him a mission to help others avoid feeling hopeless.
You hope people will be inspired?
Yeah.
To do what?
To just do what I'm doing and change the world.
And help other people?
Yeah.
Kavanaugh hopes eventually to be mayor and maybe even president. He's only 7. Makes you wonder what he'll accomplish when he's 8. For CBS This Morning, Chip Reed, Gaithersburg, Maryland.
Yeah.
Protect that child at all costs.
I know. From the G and Ursula Show, here is G. Scott. I don't want to bring this up, but you were wrong about last week's game.
What'd I say? What score?
I think you said the Seahawks would win. It was going to be 21-0.
Okay, well, look, let me go ahead and crush a lot of dreams with what I'm going to say. I'm always going to get on a radio and say the Seahawks are going to win.
Oh.
Yeah.
So, in other words, there's really no point in me asking you.
No.
For those of us who are trying to make money on these games, you're no help.
No. I'm always going to say they're going to win.
Uh-huh.
But I'm also going to talk about the game, and I'm going to talk about maybe the score. Now, I was completely wrong on the score.
Yes, you were.
Totally wrong. And then, guess what? I do think the Seahawks are going to win this week, too.
You do. Good.
And I have some reasons why.
Let's hear what they are.
Well, here's the thing about this Rams team. Yes, I'm nervous. I'm nervous every single game. But this Rams team that they're playing is a very inconsistent team. It's because of their quarterback play. You just don't know what Jared Goff, who's their quarterback, you just don't know which one you're going to get. You with this Rams team, sometimes, some weeks, they play like the best in the league, and then the next week they'll play like one of the worst. I'm counting on them hopefully playing like one of the worst. That would be nice for them to do that. It's going to be rough, though, considering they did lose to the Miami Dolphins recently. And so this Rams team is just very inconsistent. Now, I know people are listening right now. They're saying, "But what about this Seahawks defense?"
Yes, what about the Seahawks defense?
Well, it's been kind of a struggle. It's something that we're not used to. We're not used to seeing a Seahawks defense out there and footballs flying over the heads of the secondary. What I mean by that is the reason why they are in cover three, the defense that they're in, is so that footballs don't go over the heads of the safeties. You want to keep everything in front. Well, we haven't been seeing that. And we also haven't been seeing a pass rush. The quarterbacks of the opposing teams are sitting back there calling Dave Ross, eating a ham sandwich, mm-hmm. and then making a pass. So you can't have that as well. So as far as things being fixed, I'm not saying that things will be fixed. Everything doesn't happen overnight. But I'm sure that they will be addressed and they will be on top of things. So it's a very important division game with the Rams, considering they play the Rams this Sunday, and then they come back home and they play against the Arizona Cardinals on Monday night. So I'm not saying every game's important, but this game's important.
What's your score prediction? Dave likes to write that down.
Yeah, you want to write that down so you
I'm
can
ready.
Bring it up?
Here we go.
I'm going to go Seahawks 33, Rams 24.
Okay, it'll still be a nail biter then.
Well, I mean, come on now. Is it that every Seahawks game?
Yeah.
I mean, every single Seahawks game is some form of a nail biter. But plus, you know, it's time for the Seahawks to give us something to look forward to, considering in this state, the Inslees, they got on TV yesterday and they basically gave us warnings telling us not to do Thanksgiving. So I'm asking the Seahawks to go ahead and do the task of giving us some Thanksgiving treats and surprises, and that would be nice if they win. Yeah, it's a lot of pressure, but they get paid a lot of money.
Any injuries we should know about going into tomorrow's game, Sunday game?
Jamal Adams, he's going to be coming back for his second game, and I think that the injury to Chris Carson that's kind of been up in the air, so hopefully we'll see if he can get back. Well, one of the concerning things is the starting center, Ethan Posick, hasn't practiced all week. They're saying that if he doesn't go, their backup is fully capable, mm-hmm. but the fact that your starting center hasn't been practicing, and today's Friday, he didn't even practice yesterday, so hopefully he's good to go.
All right. G. Scott joins Ursula at 9 o'clock, Cairo Radio. Thanks, G.
Thanks, guys.
Time for the Pete Carroll Show, and Coach coming off a loss in Buffalo. Long plane ride home, and you guys are 32-8 after a regular season loss, and a win percentage is basically 13 games that you would win in a 16-game schedule at that win percentage. What do you do on the plane ride home? Are you watching film trying to get right to it, or do you rest when you got a long ride home after a loss like that?
Andrew. No, actually, for me, the longer the ride, the better.
Okay.
Because I get to get through all the film and the TV copy and go back and get around the plane, talk to the coaches, players, and get back to whatever I need to look at it again. So it's a really big session for me. There's no rest. I don't sleep on the planes.
Yeah, I can't sleep on a plane either. So, yeah, that's always been tough for me. Let me ask you about the turnover battle. And both the losses that you've had this year, you guys have lost the turnover battle. But you've always stressed that. That's always been a big deal with you. When did that philosophy start, and who sort of influenced you early on?
You know, I got connected to this stuff, the turnover thing, a long time ago. And it was just – that was really just kind of an evolution of our coaching together with guys who had grown up, you know, all the way back to NC State and way back there, you know, when we really started to realize how big a factor it was in the games. I didn't know the statistics that we know now and how crazy it is. You know, it's so impacting to be in the plus category, you know. And you know, I had a stat at SC, I think we won 52 games when we were plus one. And 52-0 when we were plus one, you know. Wow. And so after those years there, it was really cemented in my brain that this is the way to focus. It's the number one thing I talk about. I talk about the philosophy of our football. It's all about the ball. You know, it's all aspects of taking care of it and putting it away and protecting it, as well as attacking it and getting it and punching it and clawing and scratching for it, you know. So that it's just been such an obvious factor that we've tried to emphasize it better than anybody in football.
Yeah, it's kind of something that I just started paying attention to, and it's amazing. Like the teams that get in the end in the playoffs, your win percentage, all those things. Hey, Coach, there was a little bit of a flare up on the sidelines that a lot of people saw, and for me, an old player, I'm like, yeah, those things happen. It was Jamal Adams, and Jamal went on and said, "Hey, this was nothing. You know, that we weren't arguing or screaming at each other or anything, but you just get passionate there on the sidelines." Just tell us a little bit about that exchange and just how that goes in general for fans that are watching.
It was not a flare-up. It had nothing to do with that. I think he had just got a sack,
yeah,
and he came off hooting and hollering, and I was hooting and hollering right with him, and the two of us were just all fired up is all it was. It had nothing to do with anything that was disrespecting or arguing, or there was nothing like that. That's not what that was. That was just a couple of crazed guys having fun, you know, based on what just happened. So that was misread.
Yeah, well, and he cleared that up as well. But also sometimes that does happen on the sidelines. You know, we've seen some of those explosions, and I've always, you know, having been down there, just kind of explained that, hey, look, it's a passionate game, man. When you're out there, it's like, you know, I don't want to say it's like being in battle, but it's pretty intense down there. So I feel like a lot is forgiven as far as politeness goes on the sidelines anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's a raw emotional game, and it's one of the parts of it that I love the most, you know, that we're able to get there and participate for hours at a time, you know, at a really high pitch, and we're doing it together. And that doesn't mean that we always say the right thing or do the right thing. Years ago, Dave, I had ripped a guy's butt after a play in a game and during the game, and it was when I was a really young coach, like my first year coach, as a matter of fact. Right. And he looked at me like, God, why would you talk to me like that? You know, right. And I was so crazy. Well, then it happened again a year later or something. Then I remember my last time was at Ohio State when it happened. I was talking to an old guy, old Ray Ellis, an old cornerback. And he looked at me like, God, coach, you know, you don't have to talk to me like that. You know, I'll do whatever you want.
Yeah.
And I really have never done that since. There's a point where, you know, you need to be poised, you know, and you need to maintain your cool and all of that. But there's also a time to be emotional and to let it go. And so you have to get used to it. You have to work at it. And it's a skill. And some coaches, you play for guys, I'm sure, that never figured that out, yeah. You know, and I did too. But I think there's a way. What's most important is that you're really effective, and the things that you say help the guy play better with the next thing that's coming his way. And just to rip somebody's butt doesn't necessarily do that.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that some more sometime, but that's a really important part of coaching, I think.
Yeah. Hey, Coach, why does it seem like every game against the Rams comes down to the wire? I mean, talk about the familiarity between these two teams. It's become quite a rivalry, and I know that a lot of people, fans of the Seahawks, think that the Rams is they are the best rival in the NFC West right now.
The week we play them, they're like the biggest game in the world, so we don't really consider anybody the rival, you know, and that's not the way we look at it, but it's a great matchup. They've done a marvelous job of coaching since Sean got there. They put together a really good team, and they've got another good team. And the fact that they're 5-3 gives us a chance to be ahead of them. You know, they've lost a couple games that they wouldn't normally lose. You know, so it's a really good team, and he's a really good football coach, and you can tell that because his team is really well balanced. They run it and they throw it. They play good D. The kicking game is solid. They don't give you much, you know, in any way, and that makes them hard to beat. And that's a real marker of a good ball coach.
How about Jared Goff? Now, Coach, I have to admit that on the radio show that I give him a hard time because on Hard Knocks he wasn't quite sure which side of the earth the sun rose on or set on, and so I was giving him a hard time about being a Cal guy and everything. But he seems like he's getting better, and under McVay, what are your thoughts of the opposing quarterback there and Jared Goff?
Well, my first thought is that you might want to get over that Stanford Cal thing, you know, and put that behind you a little
bit. It's never happening, Coach. Not happening.
Pick on him just because he's a Cal guy, but
yeah.
I do, being a Northern California guy, I understand that. you know, he is a really good player, and they use him really well. Sean knows how to put him in the good positions. You know, he's only been sacked 10 times this year. They really feature the play action game and get him on the edge a lot. For a guy that's not a big mobile guy, he handles that really well. But that's calling those plays for him. You know, they're calling the plays to get him a chance to get out of the pocket so that he can be safe and solid and all that. Doesn't always get them a lot of yards, but they also have a very good drop-back game that they utilize real quick tempo and try to, you know, they like to play catch with the ball and not necessarily fire the ball all over the field, but use the field horizontally and try to, you know, control the sticks and stuff. And so they've got a really good setup, and it's a really good format for him.
All right, Coach, here's a ridiculous question. How do you stop Aaron Donald? Somebody said that, and I was like, nah, how about slow him down? I mean, he's such a dynamic player, and what makes him so good? And, you know, how do you slow a guy like that down?
Well, he's extremely explosive as an athlete. He's really fast. He's a 4.6 guy, and he plays like it. And sometimes guys are 4.6, and they don't have that kind of quickness. But he's got excellent, excellent quickness, and as powerful as he is, kind of a little bit smaller than the typical three technique would be, but it's to his advantage because he's so darn quick and he's got long arms. So that combination with the intensity that he plays with really makes him a great player. It's just a remarkable makeup of an athlete with a great brain and a great mentality, you know. So he's an all-timer. He's as good at his position as anybody that's ever played.
All right, Coach, we appreciate your time. Thanks so much. Good luck.
All right, Dave, take care.
The Pete Carroll Show on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM, where the 12s hear the Seahawks.
You can ring my bell.
Seattle's Morning News, Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan, all of us isolating. And here's Rachel Bell, who is not isolating today, but is taking all the necessary precautions so she can come in and tell us about a story that normally we'd be proud of, because the New York Times, and the New York Times is a very big newspaper.
It sure is.
Featured a local Seattle dive bar. But I guess it doesn't stop there.
That's right. So there was an article that was published in the New York Times all about dive bars, like you said, and it was written by Mike Seeley, who is the former editor-in-chief of Seattle Weekly. He also wrote this book called Seattle's Best Dive Bars. He's kind of a dive bar expert. And so you look at this piece, and the photo they use is really quite pretty. It shows this bar in Denver called My Brother's Bar, which is the city's oldest. It's been open for 147 years, and you see in their parking lot that they set up these really cool, lit-up, igloo-like domes with tables and chairs inside so people can socially distance in bad weather.
Giant tents. Giant transparent tents.
Yeah, they're little igloos. And so the piece is all about how dive bars have been slowly going extinct. And people thought, well, for sure they're going to be wiped out by the pandemic, but these bars are actually like cockroaches. They're hard to kill, and some of the owners are getting creative and dynamic. So that's what the story is supposed to be about. But Mike Seeley chose one Seattle bar to highlight in this story, and it's the Five Point, which is one of our oldest bars. It's been around since 1929. And he interviewed the bar's owner, Dave Meinert, who also owns and did own many other bars in the city. The problem is that last year, during part of the Me Too movement, 11 women came forward and alleged that Dave Meinert sexually assaulted them. And some of those accusations included rape. Now, Meinert had never been charged for any of these allegations. Not all of them. Most of them were never reported to police at the time. The ones that were had already passed the statute of limitations because all of these 11 happened over the past 20 years. But this was heavily covered in local media. And Dave Meinert was shunned not only by just the community in Seattle, but his business partners, you know, bought him out. People wanted nothing to do with him. Even politicians like Dow Constantine and Governor Jay Inslee returned or donated Meinert's contributions that he gave. He ended up buying the Mecca in Queen Anne, but losing the Comet and Lost Lake and Grimms, which are all favorite Capitol Hill places. And so because of this, I started seeing on social media, because I follow a lot of people in the Seattle food world, people who are really upset that out of every single dive bar you could have featured in the country or in Seattle, they chose to highlight Dave Meinert.
Well, did they know?
Well, they say that there's no way that Mike Seeley couldn't have known, because this was written up all over the place. And as somebody who was kind of a part of that scene, they figured he had to have known. But they're also upset with the New York Times, saying, you know, the New York Times usually does quite a bit of fact checking.
Yeah.
If you just Google the word Dave Meinert, all these stories come up. You know, these are the first things that come up before even the places that he owns come up. So people, including, I'm not going to name any names because I reached out and nobody wanted to do an interview with me. Several restaurant owners who are female, food writers who are female, and then just a lot of women, many who live on Capitol Hill and, you know him in this scene.
Yeah. And what is his side of this?
Haven't heard from him yet about this, either Mike Seeley or...
When this came out originally last year, did he have an explanation?
He said that he was, quote, handsy with some women, but that's all that he said. And as more allegations came in, he stopped responding altogether.
I see. Well, there you go. So what next? I mean, I this is the kind of thing where everybody just, what, boycotts the place?
A lot of people were already boycotting his places, but I don't think a lot of people know the story. I think what people might want right now is for the New York Times to make a note on the article or maybe redact something. They just they just don't like the idea that he's getting national publicity after he's done something so wrong. And it kind of, you know, points out that a lot of this is what they're saying is that, you know, even after these accusations, a white man in this society can still have his comeuppance and get written up in the New York Times for something totally different.
Yeah. So are they objecting to him making a living at all, or just the idea that the New York Times gave him all this publicity?
You know, I think if they had their way, he wouldn't own any businesses. But since there hasn't been any legal procedures around these 11 accusations, there's nothing you can do. But I think people would rather him not be highlighted and not boosted up and not saying, wow, look what a great thing this guy is doing. Like, maybe just let him do his thing quietly and not pay a lot of attention to him.
Yeah, well, it is a nice article.
It is.
So, and I
it
guess
is, except
if,
for that.
Yeah, and if somebody was, let's say, on the other end of the handsiness, they don't appreciate seeing that in the New York Times.
No, they certainly don't.
Yeah.
And yeah, the bar that he purchased last year, which is one of my favorite bars, called the Mecca in Queen Anne, some of these women say that is actually where they were sexually assaulted. And so it felt like a slap in the face that he went and purchased this place where he, in the past, had taken women to kind of corner them and take advantage of them.
Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Dave.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.